This week on the show, Flash versus HTML5, watching the Olympics on the web, and super fast Google connections, right here on This Week in Media, number 171. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media, and this is Alex, and we've got the usual suspects, and of course a special guest as well. So coming in from San Rafael, is it San Rafael, Daisy?
It's close to San Rafael. We can just call it Marin County.
Marin County, Daisy Daisy Whitney, and from L.A. It's usually somewhere in L.A. I think it's L.A. Tim.
Yeah, Los Angeles. I'm actually in Pasadena, California today, but yeah, greater good. L.A. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And coming in from Boston, we've got video podcasting pioneer Steve Garfield. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Alex. Good to be here. Thanks for having me. This is very exciting. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you on. So we've got a lot of news and not a lot of time, so we're going to start cranking through all of these. The first one, and this one just came up over the weekend. This is a Kevin Smith was deemed too wide for a Southwest flight, and used Twitter to kind of voice his concern. Daisy, what's up with this story?
Well, I think probably by the time our listeners are listening to this show, most of them will have checked out a lot of the blog posts and tweets on it. But it's really sort of a fascinating study on how powerful the customer is in today's culture. I mean, when you're interacting with a brand, wherever it is, I mean, he has obviously tons of followers being a celebrity. And clearly, you know, we don't have that many, but it's interesting. What's most interesting to me is kind of how much say you really do have and how effective that you can be by voicing concerns in social media forums. I mean, essentially, a pilot, he flew standby on a Southwest flight, so he switched from one flight to another. There was only one seat left, and he is a large guy. And the pilot had come out and said, you know, I'm sorry, you have to have two seats. So he was not too happy about that. He took another flight, and I guess, from what I understand, he was able to just be in one seat on the other flight. So there seems to have been some inconsistency on the part of Southwest, which I think is one of the important things that you know, I surveyed a lot of people on Twitter today before the show. I wanted to know, do you agree or disagree with Southwest policy? Because the airline does have a policy for what they call customers of size. And I actually read it this morning. It's really fascinating, you know, for anyone who's kind of interested in, you know, sort of the deeper customer service issues behind it. And they talk about how, you know, if an armrest can't go down and your body is occupying part of another seat, you have to pay for two seats. And there are certain rules in terms of, you know, you get a lower fare and whatnot. But I think that the trouble that Southwest ran into was, again, there seemed to be some inconsistency, especially in this particular case, not just in general, but in terms of how it was applied. Like, sometimes he needs two seats, sometimes it's one. And I think that's also part of the policy, that it can be applied on a case-by-case basis. And also, in airlines, the pilot always has the final say. So you're sort of dealing with another level of, you know, rulemaking and laws. But what I really want to hear, especially from Steve and Tim, and Steve, I let's just plug your book for a sec. Steve also just wrote a book on online video and how to get seen. So he's very familiar with, you know, kind of marketers and what they're doing online. But what I think is interesting is this came to light because of Twitter, because he tweeted about this constantly and Southwest did respond to him. So should Twitter be in the purview of the marketing department of a company or a customer service department? Because this is kind of, this sort of overlaps. What do you think, Steve?
I think that customers have to be, you know, watching Twitter continuously, and that's, whole businesses have sprung up for this. And in software, too. I mean, they just have to watch what people are saying. I mean, it all goes back to listening to the customer. And, you know, Kevin Smith has, like, whatever it is, 1.6 million people watching him. And it even gets expanded more, because all I'm seeing on my Twitter stream is everybody talking about it. Chris Perillo, and then he has all his followers. So they have to listen. And then as to how they respond, I think that the person on Twitter was doing a very good job, you know, immediately responding to him and saying, you know, we're so sorry this happened, and let us get our vice president, you know, to call you this afternoon. You know, what's your phone number? I think the Twitter person was very good, but I think the follow-up after, on, like, for example, on the South by Southwest blog, wasn't as good. So, you know, companies have to make sure that they're good on all of their communication platforms.
Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, they used to say that one upset customer would tell 10 others. That used to be the old fashioned marketing term, you know, and I know that when I'm upset, it's at least 15,000 you know, here. And when he's upset, it's millions. And it's, but I think that and especially when someone's complaining, on something like Twitter, where things can be retweeted, I know that there have been things that I get, you know, I've said either good or bad, that then get retweeted sometimes as much as 100 or 200 times. And so that's, you know, the chain reaction. And the reason that they get retweeted, I think, is because they strike some nerve that people agree with, and then they move it moves forward. And I know that there's companies, for instance, companies like Salesforce, who we do some work with, you know, they have all kinds of tools so that the company-wide, or the people who are accountable for this stuff online, can really keep track and manage, you know, anytime your specific brand pops up. And they're not the only ones. There's a lot of companies that do that. Now, Tim, have you ever used Twitter to vent?
Yeah, I have, but I've learned to be a little bit careful about it. I mean, you know, for someone who goes after sponsors, you have to be careful about what you say about those sponsors. So if you're going to pick a fight in public, you need to make sure that the fight that you're picking won't bring the cops, you know?
Watch out, Tim.
Yeah. I've tweeted a lot on when I've flown South by Southwest, and I think they do a really, really good job of monitoring their Twitter stream and paying attention to what the customers are saying and rewarding their customers. And, you know, even though they do that, I think that this Kevin Smith situation is all their fault. I don't know if you guys travel on Southwest that often, but they give away free peanuts, and sometimes you get drink coupons, and I think that's why Kevin is the way that he is.
He does fly a lot.
He's flown a lot, and he's the beers and the peanuts, and it's their fault.
You know, it doesn't have to take. It doesn't take very much. You know, you have a couple of extra 100 calories per day, and you'll gain 10 pounds a decade, or 100 pounds a decade, 10 pounds a year. So, you know, it doesn't take that many, you know, cans and peanuts before you're really adding it up.
I love having Tim on the show. There's always great comic relief from you every single week. I mean, I just think, like, he really shared some great zingers before we even started. And I got to tell the listeners, we told him, save that. We got to use that one again. It's so good.
So I think we've beaten the Kevin Smith story into the ground. But I do think it's interesting that the it really is becoming, you know, a lot of us thought it was going to be Big Brother, and it really is becoming the revenge of Little Brother.
You're right. I mean, I just came from the iMedia conference, which, you know, I Skyped in briefly last week from it, and that so much of the theme of that conference was all about the customer. I mean, one of our keynotes on the second day after we did TWIM last week was Doug Levy, who is the CEO of IMC Squared, which is one of the largest independent media agencies, and he just gave a phenomenal keynote on, you know, just interacting with customers. And a lot of our other speakers talked about that as well. And it just reminds me, I think, just as anybody who markets to any degree, whether it's independent producers who listen to our show, the independent producers who are on our show, we have to remember that it is a constant dialogue, that we are going to make mistakes. And that if we do make mistakes like Southwest did, you have to be prepared to, you know, to rectify them quickly and in an appropriate manner. And that also when we are acting as customers, that, you know, when we don't have our producer, you know, marketer hat on, then we're just pure customers, that we have a lot more say than we used to. And that is creating a lot of interesting new dynamics for brands big and small. I mean, it truly is a massive change in marketing and branding.
And I think you can really soften someone's message. I mean, I know that I softened a little bit on a Comcast situation where I had a problem with Comcast, and I Twittered about it. I was a little tweaked about the whole thing. And to me, it was more also, it was just a fun opportunity to be goofy about it. And so I tweet, you know, I was, tweeting away, and literally within minutes, I had responses from Comcast. And it wasn't because I had a lot of. I mean, you get that they're just managing that. You know,
did they show up at your door?
They didn't, but they offered to. They offered to send somebody over to help, you know, do whatever that needed to be done. I was like, no, I just want a refund for the stuff I didn't pay for. So, and I got that, you know, and so, but it was amazing how quickly that they responded. And I think companies that manage this well, you know, for me as a user, it was like a, wow, there is a light on it over there, you know, and that was, so I think it can be really used, that responsiveness can be really used to their benefit from a company that usually, you know, that I spend a lot of time whacking. And it, you know, definitely softened my opinion because they were reactive, you know, and it felt like they were actually going down the right direction. So it was,
you can create a lot of goodwill as you learn, Alex, when you respond to somebody. I mean, when people respond to me on Twitter about things they want to hear about on TWIM, I always try to respond quickly and let them know why we aren't covering it, or just that I appreciate their contributions. And I do. Thank you all for all your contributions.
Well, I definitely know that there are a lot of stories that we cover on TWIM and MacBreak and TWIP that are driven from people following us on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So it is an important medium. So let's move on. We've got, go ahead.
Before we go on, there's like one other part of the story that I found really interesting is that as I saw on Twitter, people were asking Kevin Smith for interviews. And they were saying, you know, we want to get you on the news tonight. We want to send a camera crew over. And he's like, no, just listen to my podcast. And he recorded his own podcast and he told his own story on his podcast and put it up on his blog.
Right.
And one media outlet sent a camera crew to his house. And he's like, no, I told you, I'm not talking to any of you. And I'm telling my story on his own thing, you know, his own platform, his podcast. So I think that's really interesting that people, you know, are going to be able to tell their own stories and bypass the media. You know, we see it and we know all about it, but he chose to just tell his story directly on his own, you know, blog.
Well, yeah, and there's definitely, he can do that. And really many people can do that because of Google, because people are going to find their way, you know, to a story. It's very, very interesting. Now, to move on, we have, of course, over the weekend, the Winter Olympics began. Who's watching the Olympics? I said I wasn't going to watch them at all, and then I ended up playing them as like background. You know, I just kind of turned them on Sunday, and I just, I was left with, there's nothing here I really want to watch. And maybe I'm not a Winter Olympics guy, but.
Yeah, I watched them. I watched Apollo Ono and the speed skating, and for a little while, you know, I was doing some reading while watching, but then it actually got kind of exciting when like the first two-thirds of the team that was leading fell down. I mean, I found that kind of comical, but you know, it was a pretty good moment there. So I actually, that's like one event that and award shows are things that I tune in to watch live. You know, it's kind of this appointment TV that's happening for me.
See, a lot of times for me, I just want to see the highlights. Okay, because I did see them wipe out, but I didn't feel like I needed to see the whole race. I just was, you know, just found it interesting to see the highlights. Now, Tim, are you watching any of the Olympics?
Oh yeah, I'm playing all the drinking games that go along with the Olympics.
What drinking games are there for the Olympics?
Well, there's the short track medley. I don't know if you know about that, but you know, if somebody falls down, you have to take a drink in speed skating. Yeah, so that
you
was,
got two
you
shots
know,
real quick.
Well, no, that's beers. You got to drink the whole beer.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, if you watch the whole entire set of speed skating, all the preliminaries, whew, let me tell you.
By the time they finished, you were finished.
There you go.
Daisy, are you watching the Olympics?
Well, I'm not, and I find this is one of the areas where not having cable or broadcast TV really hinders me. and I know that many of the events are available online, but as I understand, it's not quite. It doesn't seem quite as extensive as it was with the Summer Olympics 2 years ago. And even so, we were, you know, as listeners will recall, even so back then, they certainly didn't have a lot of the marquee events and all of the events online. And interesting, you know, Jason Perrier, who's one of our show producers and planners and helps us out immensely with finding stories in advance. He's Canadian. So he brought this one story to my attention. I guess, as I understand, he said, you know, with the Canadian online coverage, you can pretty much watch every aspect of the games on TV, VOD, online, mobile, and in other places, which, so I guess sort of the alternative coverage is, is much better up there. And yeah, I'm not really tuning into curling on the web. So, but again, I'm following it on Twitter, which is just, you know, I mean, this is such a powerful media, but that's where, you know, on Friday night, I was doing some writing and I just had TweetDeck open to just kind of watch. Like, I felt like I was not there. I'm not going to say I felt like I was there or it wasn't the same as watching it, but it was really interesting that that was sort of satisfactory just to kind of follow the stream of what people were saying and their reactions to the opening ceremony. I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, so there, and they dropped it from some of the facts here is that they dropped, NBC dropped from 2,200 hours of live footage from Beijing to 400 of online video, and which is mostly the curling and hockey.
Yeah, what's the thinking behind that? I don't understand that. I'm not, you know, I think NBC definitely got some knocks initially with the Beijing games, although in the end really put together some, frankly, very impressive numbers. I don't have them off the top of my head, but I remember, you know, at the end it was deemed a wide success. So I'm kind of surprised that it's been scaled back to this extent.
Well, they're losing money.
Maybe that's the reason.
Yeah. I mean, NBC used to make a lot of money. They're not making that much money anymore.
Right. Right, Steve. Do you see do you think that's the reasoning for cutting down on the hours?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why they couldn't stream live, because, you know, I go to events around Boston and, you know, wherever I am. I mean, I was over at Macworld this weekend, and the event, the iPad event, wasn't being streamed live, and I was asking them, "No one's streaming this live." So
we
just
were.
Sat in the,
we were.
Well, the streaming the iPad event?
Yeah, we Leo was inside and he literally turned Skype on, turned his computer around and just shot it, you know, live, and it was streaming on twit.tv. We had 115,000 live viewers.
Oh, that was the Leo Laporte segment.
But there was no official stream. No. You're talking about Macworld.
So
Macworld.
No,
you're not talking about the actual iPad event.
Well, at Macworld.
Oh no,
I
missed that part.
Leo Laporte, he did his show, and there were, like what you said, like 150,000 people watching it live. And then the next event after that was the iPad discussion event. And I said, so is that going to be streamed live too? Because everyone was tweeting me, we want to see it, we want to see it. And I said, well, I'll look into streaming it live. And so I just sat in the front row like Leo did at the actual iPad event. And I helped flip my PowerBook around and streamed it live from the front row. So, right. I mean, if it's just easy enough for Leo and me to stream live from just sitting in anywhere, I don't see why it's so difficult to stream the Olympics.
Well, no. You know.
Maybe we should just send you next time. We're just going to send Steve to turn his laptop around.
You know, there's a funny skit there somewhere of people like at the Olympics with their laptops, you know, just like, you can imagine someone going by skiing and the person's like panning his laptop along with the, you know, with the, sorry.
I've actually been at conferences where they've sent security after people like Steve.
Oh, well, I mean, I was waiting for Leo to get shut down. You know, I thought it was too, you know, I was kind of surprised he made it all the way through. I'm sure they just Apple didn't want to make a scene, but I told Leo, I was like, well, that's probably the last time you're getting invited to an Apple event, you know, because I guess he said Steve was looking over at him, giving him the stink eye. And it's not like Steve doesn't know who Leo is. So it's not like he's some random guy out there, you know, streaming, you know. So anyway,
I have to ask Steve a Boston question. This
yeah,
is
okay.
Something that's been made. Do you watch 30 Rock?
Oh, I do. Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
I love that show, and I find Julianne Moore's accent to be a bit extreme with the Nancy Donovan role. As a Bostonian, is she over the top with this current Boston? Every time I watch it, I turn to my husband and go, it seems like a parody of a Boston accent. What do you think?
Actually, so are you talking about a recent show? Right? Recent?
Yeah.
Because I've got them stacked up on my DVR, so that's like
okay.
A little spoiler. I haven't seen that yet, so I'll have
to
hold
judgment
on that.
We'll have to table that conversation.
Yeah.
When you get through the January episodes, we'll circle back on it.
Oh, man, I'm so far behind.
and I'm far behind, too. So it wasn't even that recent, so I don't want you to think I was spoiling anything.
All
too.
Right. No,
but yeah, we'll circle back on that at another time.
So now one thing that could help you get caught up with all of this, of course, and you see is Google providing super fast internet service. Have you guys seen this? So this is Google's talking about introducing a ultra high, this 1 gigabit per second connection.
Would that be WiMAX? Is that WiMAX?
I think they're actually going to use fiber for this. And so this is, but they're basically, they're talking about, it's a Fios, you know, fiber to the home, is what people are saying that. I don't think Google has figured out exactly how it's going to do it yet. I think it just said it was going to do it. So, it's 1 gigabit per second, fiber to the home, it looks like. And, the idea is really to push the industry forward. I think Google's getting in, can see that there's lots of business opportunities with people using online all the time. And they're trying to kind of push this down the path. They said they could serve as few as 50,000, as many as 500,000 people, that they want to make this available to. Now, first question, Tim, do you think you're going to get this? Are you up for it? Do you think you could handle a gigabit per second?
Well, what do they have in Europe right now?
Only place that I think they're getting speed, they're testing a gigabit per second. I think it was a test in Finland. I want to say
Finland or Denmark,
something like that, where there was like a guy's mother or something had like this crazy fast connection that they were testing. But they've been, most of the time when we're talking about really fast internet, we're talking about Korea or Japan running at 100 megabits per second. So 1 gigabit per second is 10 times faster than that. And I have to say that it does change. When I was in Japan, the hotel I was staying in had 100 megabit connection. And it does completely change the way you use the internet, because you just watch everything. Everything just downloads. Everything is just fast. And it does change the way you kind of approach a lot of that stuff when you're able to.
It really boils down to price point. You know, if it's free, yeah, I'm in. If it's the same price as my DSL, yeah, I'm in. If it's 10 times the price of my DSL, okay, probably not.
So let's say it was available for, let's say it was available for $200 a month. You could have 1 gigabit per second. Steve, would you buy it?
That sounds a little high
for a gigab. So what do you have now? What's your speed right now?
I have it's rated at like 16, and they're talking about Xfinity coming to Boston, and that is supposed to be like around 100. So I would like wait and see what 100 is like before thinking that I need a gigabit. But I would love to have it. I would, but I don't know how much I'd want to pay for it. I mean, maybe 100 is enough. I mean, I remember back when you're talking about video, where we used to subscribe to video podcasts and download them overnight. So like the next day they'd be on our disc and we could watch them fast. But now, I go to YouTube and places, and I don't really have much, or Hulu, I don't have much lag on watching online video. I mean, I don't see it as really that slow right now.
And to kind of put it in perspective, a gigabit per second, is 100. A gigabit per second is basically 150 megabytes a second. So, so what you're really looking at is, for people listening, just kind of throw the math out there. What you're talking about is being able to download an HD. What would be on iTunes is an HD video in about 10 seconds. So you're I want to put it on my iPod. I can just download it in 10 seconds and throw it up.
Oh, to download it and watch it later, because streaming is working pretty well, and the downloading and watching it later. I never do that. So the speeds that I have now for just clicking and watching seem to be pretty good.
Well, a lot of it though also can affects the speed, and there is a certain breaking point somewhere where the speed also affects the quality. So like you're watching downloaded video, downloaded HD, that HD could be a lot higher quality if for instance, the Blu-ray that you might watch, one of those might be 20, let's say 25 gigabytes of information, for the full quality, as good as the disc kind of thing. Now, downloading that even on a 16, a megabit pipe would take a long time.
Oh, yeah. So what you're saying is this could open up the door to all kinds of, better quality enhancements.
I mean, this could be the end of the disc completely.
Oh,
this kind of speed means that there's no reason to. This is fast enough that it would make it unclear whether you needed to have a disc drive. When you talk about cloud computing, I mean, it would be as fast. It would basically be as fast as your drive is. Uh-huh. As far or very close to it. You know, it would be capable
okay,
of doing it.
Okay, okay, I'll pay $200.
Tim, would you pay $200?
No, no. $200. I could get a second car for $200. I mean, that's just it's.
Where's the breaking point for you? 100?
Yeah, maybe around 100. Okay. I mean, it depends on you know, am I going to be what else am I going to be able to get rid of? Because I don't want to pay another monthly fee. I'm just sick and tired of monthly fees. Right.
Right. I think my monthly cable for internet is like $72 or something.
Yeah, that's what it is.
You know, so maybe what would I pay double that, 140? Right. I might.
Yeah. I mean, I would if I got this, I would definitely not be buying TV. I mean, wow. You know, there'd be no reason for me to. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, at that, if I had that kind of speed and I was paying that kind of money, I would turn the cable off immediately. Daisy's already done that. Daisy, would you pay for this kind of speed?
Well, I would pay for it if it would significantly enhance the amount of free time I had in my life. So it is. Would I pay $200? It's pricey, but I think about the amount of video that we're uploading in our house. I mean, my husband is a videographer, and you know, uploading the videos that I do each week, it doesn't take a ton of time. But if it would reduce the amount of time that I have to babysit video uploads, yeah. I mean, if it just went like that in a snap. And it didn't take, you know, 15 minutes or whatever it is. I could see it potentially being worth that because I feel like for somebody in my position, I'm balancing, you know, kids and work and, you know, all of these other things. You know, you make a lot of decisions based on just the amount of time that you're freed, that frees up. So if it freed up enough time, I could see paying, you know, double what high-speed internet access costs right now.
I mean, another terrifying thing that people have talked about is, you know, the main reason that the music industry was the one that's taken the brunt of the BitTorrent actions and so on and so forth has been because songs are small. You know, as far as, you know, if everybody had a gigabit connection, you know, the ability to share, you know, any movies that they wanted to would be, you know, that would be greatly enhanced. So, you know, obviously the movie industry may not be as excited about a super fast connection because that's kind of depressed some of the, you know, moving stuff around. Steve, you were going to say something?
All I was going to say was I was going to tell Daisy that she has to pay $200 extra for the download speed and then it's $200 more extra for the upload.
Well, maybe not then.
So anyway, so it'll be interesting. I was talking to Leo and I'm trying to figure out how we can get it into Petaluma. I'm like, we gotta figure out a way that Google's gonna give us the fast connection because of course we have to test it. You know, we have to. You know,
you guys are always trying to take over the world. I can see it now
from Petaluma of all places.
Yeah. We're gonna make Petaluma the media capital of the world.
Well, Boston can't even get Fios, so I don't know.
My cousin has Fios just outside of Boston.
Yep, and Boston city proper doesn't.
I was visiting his house and I downloaded a file three times because I kept on thinking it wasn't working. Suddenly I looked down, there was like three copies on my desktop. I was like, oh, okay, it's actually working. So, so anyway, we had a, and this is a question, Daisy, you said there was a question from someone about HTML5.
Yeah. So Doug Walker, who is a regular listener, wants to know if you can give a breakdown on how HTML5 does handling video as opposed to Flash. He said, you know, we all know that Apple has anointed HTML5 as the delivery system of the future. But, you know, what do video producers have to do and need to know to implement it?
So I can't say that I'm a expert on HTML5 as far as all the little details. But I will say that, you know, one of the things that HTML5 has in its setup, the big thing that I think that Adobe's concerned about specifically is what was called Canvas, which is the ability to play back video, to add interactivity. A lot of those things are things that have been up until now really a domain that was owned by Adobe and, you know, in Flash. And HTML5 looks to be able to maybe not do everything that Flash does, but maybe do a lot of what Flash does on the surface. And so if you look at what Adobe can do with Flex and with a lot of the deep action scripting and everything else, that's still not going to be, I don't think that's going to, you know, Flash, I mean, HTML5 is going to equal that. And I think that's what they were talking about. I think when John Knack was talking about the, you know, that we'd go back into the dark ages of video, it's that it won't have all the things that Flash does. But of course, it theoretically could be more stable than Flash. And I think all of us have had a variety of Flash delays and issues. I think that one thing that you notice is how much Flash ties up your bandwidth when you I have a thing called click to flash on both my Firefox and my Safari. So when I open up a page that has flash in it, it won't. It just shows me a gray screen, and I can selectively turn the flash on in any window that's there, or decide not to. And when you do that, A, you see how much flash is being used on a day-to-day basis, and B, how much it's slowing you down. So I think that's people's complaint. I think that the issue with HTML5, regardless of whether it's as good as Flash, I think is that you know both Apple and I this is my opinion, that both Apple and Google tend to want to do one of two things to every technology, and that's control it or commoditize it. So the and I've read that somewhere about Google. I think it's, in some ways it's about Apple as well, which is they want it to be either wide open and everyone using it, or they want to have ownership over it. And Apple tends to lean more towards the control, and Google leans more towards commoditization. But the two of them kind of want both of those things. Those are good, and those are good business things to do. But of course, Flash is not one of those things, and it's very difficult to do one or the other. And so I think both Apple and Google would prefer Flash not to exist. And I think that that's the challenge that Adobe is running up against, because Apple and Google are both really pushing HTML5 because they want to have developers not using Flash. And once again, because they can't control it and they can't commoditize it. And so I think that is less of a technical thing and more of a political thing that's going on with HTML5. So that's my opinion.
I've changed my YouTube setting now through one of our producers, John Riley, said, hey, click on this and you can have everything, I guess, viewed in HTML5. And just, I'm not going to try to put on a geek hat because that's, I'm obviously not immersed in the technical details, but almost every video works just fine on YouTube. There have been one or two times where I get some, where it tries to load and I get some sort of note that's, I don't remember exactly what it says, but trying to load HTML5 and then the video never winds up loading. So I've run across one or two glitches on YouTube, but I would say by and large, just purely from the consumer standpoint, seems to be working fine.
Right. And there's a lot of things under the belly of Flash that you're not going to have access to, at least in the first version of HTML5. But I think from a consumer's point of view, it'll work just fine. And I think we're seeing a lot of, YouTube has converted almost its entire library to H.264 as it is. And I think that one of the other stories that we had here is that Hulu, there's a rumor that is pushing around that Hulu is making versions of all of its videos using H.264 and not with, not using Flash. So Hulu is trying to build one. And of course, Hulu's concern, or this is according to TechCrunch, is of course making sure that its content is available for the iPad, which, the iPad really, may be a driver for a lot of this, depending on how popular it is. And I guess it's hard to believe that the iPad may be coming out next week.
Oh, wow. For people who are listening, there was a really good, you mentioned TechCrunch, there was a really good article by Jeremy Allaire, and it was titled The Future of Web Content, HTML5, Flash, and Mobile Apps. Mm-hmm. And he wrote probably the best article I've seen about HTML5 and what it's all about. And when you scroll down and look at it, you can see that everyone's promoting a different video format. There's the Barkey format.
Yeah.
I love the Barkey format.
Yeah. So there's the Barkey format, and Apple likes H.264, and I'm just reading a little bit here. Microsoft likes something called VC1, which I'm not familiar with. And Firefox has Ogg Vorbis. And so there's a whole bunch of different video formats that would be supported by HTML5. So
it's a bunch of different ones. I mean, I think most of us can. I think most of us would agree that the clear leader at the moment, anyway, is H.264.
And do we need to agree on one for HTML5 to work, or can they be multiple formats?
It can be multiple formats, except that it's just from a video producer's perspective, it's a lot simpler if we just start doing the same thing.
Right.
We can talk about all these ones, and everyone has their own individual needs. I mean, H.264 is not Apple's format; it's a format, and Apple has handled it. YouTube has adopted it. It's part of the Blu-ray spec. So it's a pretty common thing. I know as someone who has to produce a lot of these videos, and you produce a lot of these videos as well, is that I just hate multiple formats.
Right.
we don't produce a lot of our stuff in a lot of different formats. We produce in the minimum number possible, and I just feel like people don't like our content. If they won't go through the trouble of making it possible to watch them, then don't watch. Because I'm just not willing to you know, make, I mean, Leo's on the other side of that. He'll make, he has like every video version. It seems like every format you can, from live to, you know, Ogg Vorbis to H.264 to all these different video and audio formats. And he's gotten really good at it. And I think it does improve the number, increase the number of listeners. He's just willing to do it. And I'm not.
It's more time though, Alex. I mean, it is, it's harder to do. I mean, I discuss this with my web designer a lot, who also, you know, advises me on, you know, sort of, you know, how I should be encoding videos, and I should have it be able to play on this device or that device. Do you want it to be able to support the iPad? And sometimes I think, my God, you know, at the end of the day, I'm just one person. It's just my husband and me producing these videos and shooting them and editing them and uploading them and distributing them. And you do have to make those tough choices sometimes about, you know, do you invest another hour or two or whatever it takes to do that. Obviously, you know, Leo has a much larger operation than I do, so it makes sense for him, and he's all about that.
Well, he did it before it even made sense. I think that, you know, one of the things that Twit has been always very committed to is, you know, being wide, you know, supporting lots of these different formats, supporting a lot of these pieces. And I think it's more of a, for him, it was less of a business decision and more of a commitment to make it, you know, available to people. You know, it's a techie show, you know, it's a tech network. So, you know, I think that makes sense for Leo. I just know that for us, I just, you know, we started going down that path, and then I just was like, oh, too much work.
Yeah, you know, for people listening, one thing I do when I go out and speak all the time is just, this is probably getting a lot of people afraid of thinking of putting video online, and one thing I do is demystify it and say, okay, let's just keep it as simple as possible. And one thing that I've been doing when making videos recently is using iMovie 09, and then I just say post to YouTube. I mean, it didn't always have that. It's kind of a recent thing that people might not know about. You can just use iMovie 09 and click a button, say post to YouTube, and it's on YouTube. And it's so easy. And then the other thing I do, the hosting platform I like is Blip TV. And if you pay for the pro version, which they gave me to test, you can click a few buttons, and they will automatically, once you post your video up to Blip, they'll put it on YouTube for you. They'll also make iPhone compatible version for you. So still, from the person who's making the video, from their perspective, they just have to make it once, upload it to one place, and then these hosting platforms can take care of all these different formats.
To some level, know? I mean, and for someone who's just basically throwing that stuff up, it totally makes sense. One of the things that we found actually is that going through the H.264 compression process ourselves, rather than allowing YouTube to do it, tends to end up, when we tweak all of our settings and get them just right, the quantization that occurs through the H.264 based on our settings, what we found is that the quality of the video actually looks nicer on YouTube, because it requires their kind of generalized compression scheme to be more efficient. And so, you know, we actually try to tweak it as much as we can on our end to get it to what we want before we upload it to YouTube, because otherwise we find that it tends to mush it up a bit. Mm-hmm. So people who are starting, going to iMovie totally makes sense. If you're really trying to tweak every little bit that you can get out of YouTube, you know, oftentimes you actually want to go through the first round of compression, which is kind of counterintuitive, because usually you want to put the highest quality thing up there that you can, you know, let YouTube figure it out. But they have a very generalized compression format that just kind of makes everything fit, mm-hmm. for lack of a better. And there's lots of things that you can do to, you know, make that work. But yeah, but it'll be interesting to see how these formats go. Now, beyond the formats, we've got this is. I thought this was kind of interesting. Speaking of iTunes and YouTube, book publishers, you know, are finding that, you know, expensive music, they're looking at this with iTunes. Expensive music equals slower sales. Daisy, can you give us a little bit more of a recap here?
Yeah, there are some interesting stories last week about this. I mean, as you know, iTunes instituted the variable pricing last year so that labels could price songs at 99 cents to $1.29. And Warner Music said that it has seen unit sales actually go down because of that, you know, down 10% in the September quarter, 11% in the June quarter. Now, this is not always a case of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. It could be that music downloads are a mature business. I mean, the story, there was a terrific story about this in All Things D that brought up this point. It might be that by pricing certain songs at $1.29, you're actually extracting more value from them because those people were going to buy the song regardless, whether it was 99 cents or $1.29. So I don't think we know yet that it is the higher price that is causing the sales to go down. But, you know, Kristen, the other thing that that the Warner CEO pointed out, perhaps it wasn't such a great idea to raise prices 30% even to $1.29 during a recession. That might have been another issue that caused the slowing of sales. But it's something for the book business to keep in mind as it goes down this path now that we're familiar with Amazon and Macmillan and, you know, the agency model that Apple is instituting with the iPad and with book publishers, of publishers being able to price books at $12.99 or $14.99. I don't think anybody knows the answers yet, because ebooks have so far really only been available at right around $9.99, some books a little bit more, some a little bit less on the Kindle. And I don't think we're really going to know until the iPad and other devices get into more hands whether slightly higher prices are going to hinder book purchases. It's just something for publishers to have in the back of their mind. On the flip side, though, I mean, there have been some questions of, you know, is this foolish of book publishers? Are they trying to, you know, put the genie back in the bottle? Have they learned from the music business? I think one thing that is good is that a lot of these pricing and availability issues are happening now rather than 5 years from now. They're happening as this ebook business is really starting to flourish. And if sort of some of these business concerns get worked out now from the get-go, I think the book business will probably be in a better position than the music business. I hope so, at least.
Well, you know, I find it, I thought about it after looking at this article, and I realized that for me, it did become less automatic for me to buy music. When it wasn't just all 99 cents. There was something about psychologically when it was more than a dollar that I found that I just flinched more often. You know, I don't know if I really need that or not. At 99 cents, I pretty much bought anything that came to my head.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know,
and
I don't
point, Alex.
I don't know what it was, but it was just like, yeah, I'll buy it. And 99 cents, as soon as they started going into 129, I know I started flinching more often, and that's when I became like, oh, I have to get a subscription service, and I moved to the, you know, using the Zune from a lot of my music. And so, I know that all precipitated after, you know, things went from 99 to, at 99, I didn't feel any need for a subscription service. You know, at 129, I started going, I should get one. I don't think if I was rationally thinking about it, that makes sense, but irrationally, that is what kind of cascaded me actually moving to a subscription service for a lot of the music that I listen to. Tim, did it affect you?
Absolutely. It, you know, my wallet suffered immensely. No, it didn't affect me.
You weren't buying any of the music anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's like I've been buying more audiobooks more than music. That mm-hmm. seems to be my iTunes purchase. I mean, occasionally I'll buy some new songs, but I'm buying videos and I'm buying audiobooks. I'm not buying music. Because I like all my music that I've had, you know, the music that
for
I
the last
20
years.
Yeah. And occasionally there'll
psychedelic
be a new song.
Furs. You're just playing that over and over
or,
again.
Yeah. Or there'll be something that comes out, or a song that I forgot that I don't have on my iPod.
Right.
I'll get that. But it's not like the days of old where I'd walk into a record store and I'd look at all the albums and I'd spend hours in the record store. I don't have that time, you
right.
know? But you think about the business model of this. Every new industry kills off the old industry before it establishes itself. And that's where we're at right now. I mean, we are still in that transitional time. And I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, it'll work itself out. TV wasn't, you know, it took 25 years for the time that a TV show first aired until there was a regularly scheduled television show that was sponsored. So,
right.
you know, it takes time.
Steve, did it affect your buying habits?
What I've noticed recently is that I used to just buy on iTunes because it was convenient, but I've also found that Amazon's pretty convenient to buy from for music too, since now I have their downloader. And the thing that's really making things convenient over on Amazon beyond music is this Amazon Prime. I don't know if you guys have signed up for that thing.
It's fantastic. It's
what I call that's like shopping crack.
Yep.
It's unbelievable. They just got me in like with that 30-day free trial, and
oh my gosh,
I'm just, why buy anything elsewhere anymore?
I order soup on Amazon. I do. I order cans of soup on Amazon because I don't have to go pick it up, and it's free to have it delivered in 2 days anyway.
I know. It is so convenient. But one thing I was thinking about just recently about buying music, and I like to buy some songs and buy popular ones and have them on the computer, but with like streaming services like Pandora and things, I'm just thinking it's kind of like, why do I need to actually buy the music? Like it was like before, you used to buy the record and then you would buy the CD and then you would like buy the MP3, but I really don't need to buy these things to have them, to listen to them. And like you said, you have a subscription service now, and I think kind of the same thing might be happening for, you know, like TV. And you said the thing about we'll be able to just download, not download, but stream. Well, that you did say download, like the Blu-ray. And I'm thinking we're moving to a time when we might not like buy these things just to have like a little memento of it. We don't really need to buy them. Maybe just rent, or, you know, so these streaming things are really coming about, and that might be the way things, you know, are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, when I look at Netflix instant play from Netflix, if that was at Blu-ray quality or near Blu-ray quality, I wouldn't buy any more discs. I think that's what Hollywood's worried about.
Now that you mention it, again, I'm going to go back to Amazon. I just look on there and I'm like, okay, yeah, buy that movie and go put it on my Den TiVo. I buy it online, right. And I say, when this movie comes out, like I bought, everybody online was talking about the movie Moon, and I hadn't seen it. And they're like, Steve, you haven't seen that? So I went on Amazon. I found it. It wasn't out yet. So I said, I ordered it, and then I just got an email the other day, and it says Moon is on your DVR. It's ready to watch, and I think that is just great.
You know, that'd be a really good dating service, wouldn't it? You know, you just fill out a profile, da, 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 and you check a couple different people you're interested in dating, and then when they become available, you get an email. These people are now available now.
I bet you there's like a Facebook app. There's a Facebook app that would say is when their relationship status changes, right. Let me know.
And then you send them something automatically with Amazon Prime.
That would be great. You could link it. We're creating like a multi-million dollar company here right now. So what you have is they're watching people's status. So you find a girl or a guy or whatever, and you set up their status so that when their status changes to single, it automatically orders something. There's like some kind of pipe there, and it sends a dozen flowers and a little singing guy. I think.
What if you want to break up with somebody? You send them a can of cream and mushroom.
Pea soup.
That's always a good. That's a good one to say. Yeah, we're done. So this is. I know this is what I'm going back to. So I think we've run this one into the ground.
Hey, Alex, can we talk briefly for like a minute about visual effects? I just wanted to throw my visual effects question out to the audience. Is that okay?
I love to talk about visual effects.
I thought you might. So I don't know. I saw the Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief movie this past weekend, and
I did not.
And Alex didn't, but we were having an interesting, and I had a conversation with my sister-in-law this weekend, who didn't work on that movie, but who works in the visual effects business, who works at Industrial Light and Magic. And I said, you know, one of the things, and I'm talking as a consumer here, I'm not talking as a media person, but I found some of the effects odd. And I don't know if it's that they were bad effects or if it was a strange concept. So I want to throw this out here to listeners who know more about visual effects than I do and how they're created. But the two in particular that I'm thinking of is, you know, there's one character who's a satyr, which is half man and half goat. And there's another character, actually the character played by Pierce Brosnan. It's funny saying it, but he's a centaur. So it's basically Pierce Brosnan's chest and head. And it looked like it was just grafted onto a big freaking horse's body. And so what I said to my sister-in-law was, I couldn't tell if they were schlocky in the execution or if it was a strange concept and a concept that's hard to pull off. And she said, you know, that can often happen when they're presented with a concept that's just strange and hard to pull off. You know, they'll often go back to the director and say, well, it's not quite working this way. Could the human half, for instance, of a centaur be a lot more stylized? Or could we pull more of, you know, the goat elements into the human half of the character or vice versa? Or even like Pirates of the Caribbean, part two, where the Bill Nighy character was based on a performance by Bill Nighy, and then he was turned into Davy Jones. So, Alex, I know you haven't seen the movie, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on sort of like what do you do when you're in the visual effects business and you're handed this strange concept. And I'm just curious, listeners, you know, tweet me or email me, DaisyWhitney@gmail.com, just on your thoughts on that, on the movie, if you've seen it.
I think the one thing I'd say is that, I mean, there are a lot of times when There's a variety of different issues that can come up when you're working on these kinds of projects. I mean, a lot of times those are fairly complex things. Mixing a human actor with any kind of character oftentimes is very challenging. And they've done it in a couple different ways. When you look at the Centaur, when you look at Harry Potter, and I don't remember which one it was. I think it was one of the first ones. First one or the second one where they're in the woods. Well,
yes.
In that one, they chose to do all digital. And he looked a little digital, you know. He looked a little like he was sculpted. He didn't. He wasn't really a human on the top part. They did it differently when you look at the Chronicles of Narnia, and they did it fairly well. And there's a lot of different ways of kind of approaching that problem. And sometimes what happens is you go down an aggressive, you know, this is the way we're going to go, and then you run out of runway before you run out of runway at the end of the deadline is up, and it may not have turned out the way you thought it was, and it might have been a more exciting way to do it that just doesn't necessarily come out on the other end. Some of it can be definitely affected by budget, where there's just not enough money to do it in the way that you had planned. I mean, an effect like that is very expensive to get done well. It also can be a lot of back and forth. A director sometimes will constantly change their mind. They'll constantly change different pieces. And sometimes a lot of directors don't realize that every time they change their mind, they're actually reducing the quality of the movie. Because what happens is they have the same, generally a similar budget, but more importantly, they have the same deadline oftentimes, you know, to deliver. And so every time they zigzag the visual effects company, they are taking away some of their own runway to get the product out the way that they really wanted it to. And so it becomes less and less what they had envisioned and more what could be done. And so so I think that is one of the big challenges. And I think a lot of directors, you know, oftentimes think and want to have kind of unlimited ability to make those adjustments all the way to the end. And very few of them realize that as they do that, they literally just, you know, kind of stretch the movie out a little bit and actually stretch the effects out. And rarely will they get the same quality as a clear vision all the way to the end would get them. And there has to be some changes. It's kind of like it's never going to be perfect. But the point is that it, you know, you have to be kind of careful. And this is not just in visual effects. This is in general production. the more clear your vision is as from the beginning to the end, oftentimes the more, cleaner it's going to, you know, come out. And so I think that's one of the big challenges there.
So Daisy, I haven't seen the movie, but based on what you're describing, I think the director had in mind the Saturday Night Live Jim Brewer goat boy character. And that could have been the problem. We probably based it on that.
He's like, and he's probably happy. He's like, it turned out just what I thought, just the way I thought.
Yeah, that could be the disconnect right there.
Now we've gotten to the source of the problem. That's what we do best here on TWIM.
We got to the source and we muddied it. That's what we do here.
Did we run it underground now?
Yes. We were to the ground. Now we're underground.
We're beating a dead horse. Sorry, go ahead.
Steve, where can people find you? Where can people find you, Steve?
People can find me at stevegarfield.com. Very simple.
Excellent. And Daisy?
Oh, and Steve, what's the name of your book?
So the book is called Get Seen, and it's available everywhere, online, bookstores. I was in New York the other week, and it's right there at Barnes & Noble on 46th and 5th. Very exciting to see it in stores. It just came out last month.
Well, we're very proud of you. You can find me online at daisywhitney.com.
And Tim, where can people find you?
OneTimStreet.com.
This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.